start off with, looking in the outer part of the ear with the microscope, we can see the outer ear and the eardrum very clearly, and these are quite normal. There's no evidence of any infection or any damage here. Behind the eardrum, there is an air-filled space and three little bones which conduct the sound waves across to the inner ear. The impedance tests that we do show a normal pressure behind the eardrum, so we know there's no blockage of the Eustachian tube by catarrh, and that the sound is free to pass through the middle ear to the inner ear. Another part of this test shows that the small bones are all moving quite freely and are all joined together. Now, when the sound waves enter the inner ear, they vibrate the fluid in the inner ear, and this is where the sound waves are going to be changed into electrical impulses which go up the nerve of hearing to the brain. The cochlea actually consists of two fluid-filled tubes, one inside the other, and the inner tube has at the bottom of it a membrane, which we call the basilar membrane, which runs all the way from the bottom of the cochlea to the top of the cochlea. At the bottom, the membrane, the basilar membrane, is tightly stretched, so it vibrates to the high-frequency sounds, the high-pitched sounds, like whistles. And at the top of the cochlea, it's loosely stretched, so it vibrates to the low-frequency sounds, like foghorns, the bass notes, that is. Now, each point on the membrane is going to vibrate to a different frequency or pitch, a musical note, and sound in our environment, speech or music or environmental sound, is made up of many different frequencies. And these patterns of frequencies are what tell us about the exact nature of any particular sound. On the basilar membrane, as you can see, there are these very beautiful hair cells, about 17,000 of them, in each inner ear. They're arranged in two groups, the inner hair cells and the outer hair cells. The inner hair cells connect by nerve fibers to the auditory nerve and send messages to the brain. The outer hair cells have a different role in making quiet sounds audible. When the basilar membrane vibrates, the inner hair cells move up and down, and the little hairs on the top bend. And it's the bending of these hairs that starts this electrical impulse, firstly within the inner hair cell, and then as it passes up the individual fiber of the auditory nerve to the brain. In very quiet sound situations, the movement of the basilar membrane is so slight that it will not excite the inner hair cell, which is relatively insensitive. In this situation, the outer hair cells actually physically vibrate themselves, and these vibrations, rather like many little tiny gymnasts bouncing on a trampoline, enhance the movement of the basilar membrane until there's enough energy to fire off the inner hair cell, so that without the outer hair cells, we can't hear quiet sounds. Now, when we're born, we have about 30% more outer hair cells than we actually need. And this is to kind of take us through our life, because they gradually die off. This is a natural process of loss of outer hair cells, which happens even from childhood. One of the things we do is to measure the outer hair cell population using a very sensitive computerized listening device. And this can tell us what the cochlear reserve is like in terms of outer hair cells, and also show us if there are any areas or irregularities in the cochlea that might be responsible for tinnitus emerging in the first place. So the inner ear does play a part, particularly in some cases as a reason for the tinnitus occurring in the first place, and that's why we need to look at it in some detail. Now, if you now look at the nerve of hearing, you can appreciate that these fibers, some 30,000 of them in the human, are carrying information about different frequencies or pitch, so that what happens is that at any moment in time, there is a kind of list or inventory of all the frequencies that are present in the auditory nerve, And then the next moment in time, this is completely changed because sound patterns are constantly changing in speech or music. Now these patterns passing up to the brain are simply lists of what frequencies are present in our sound environment at any particular one time. They don't tell us where those individual frequencies come from or which belong together in making a particular sound or coming from a particular sound location. However, when we get to the cortex of the brain, which is where we actually hear sound, this is where all our intelligent thinking and all our feeling and control of voluntary activity takes place. And this area, which is concerned with the hearing perception, is just above the ear and under the skull. But it takes quite a little journey for the messages to get from the ear to this hearing cortex, where the sounds are perceived. And on their way there, they pass through a very important area in the subconscious part of the brain. That's the part that we don't really have any understanding or feeling about. We don't know that it's there. Now, these subconscious or sub-awareness pathways have often been shown in pictures to look rather like cables, inert cables that don't do very much. But if you look carefully under a microscope, you can see that actually these messages are passing through hundreds of thousands of little tiny nerve cells. These are rather like very complicated intelligent switches. But they're switches that aren't just joined to two wires. They might be joined to 100 different fibers of nerves going in all sorts of different directions. Now, when we look at all these nerve cells together, we refer to them as a nerve network or a neuronal network. And what they're able to do is they're able to receive the patterns or lists of frequencies coming from the cochlea and to identify those frequencies which belong together. Now, we do this on the basis of learning, because when we're very small, everything does sound just like a whole kind of soup of different frequencies all mixed together. And then we have to identify the various different sounds and what they mean. This is all learning about our sound environment when we're very small. What happens is that as the patterns of sound become familiar, they pass up through these subconscious pathways where they leave a kind of memory footprint behind. And the next time that sequence of frequencies comes through the subconscious, it excites the memory footprint, and those frequencies are tagged or labeled so that when they get to the hearing cortex of the brain where they're perceived, the brain realizes that that is a specific sound location or sound generator. And that's how we're able to separate out all these frequencies and get this perception of our sound environment completely reconstructed so we can identify all the various different sound locations around us, each of which can be quite complex, like the kettle in the kitchen, the sound of a car outside, central heating, the radio, someone speaking. All of these things may be going on together, but when we hear them as separate entities. So this everyday experience shows us that there is a lot of very dynamic activity going on between the point where this information leaves the ear and the point where it arrives at our conscious perception in the hearing cortex. We're going to talk about this process of pattern recognition later, but there's something else that these subconscious or sub-awareness pathways do besides just recognize the different patterns. It can also enhance these patterns or suppress them very strongly on the basis of whether they're important or whether they're not important. We're all familiar with the everyday experience of hearing the sound of our first name in a nearby conversation. And this is very strongly enhanced. So we always turn to it and we hear our first name, whereas we may very well not hear anything else in the conversation, even though the other words were spoken at the same intensity as the sound of as our first name was. Also, we can think of other sounds around us that are very strongly suppressed, like the sound of the refrigerator in the kitchen, for instance, and there are lots of other everyday sounds around and about us. If we have lived for a long time near a road or a motorway, we may be really completely unaware of those sounds. Some people can live near airports and yet not hear the sound of really quite loud jets taking off. Of course, other people are distressed by them, but on the whole, people habituate or block sounds that are not of any particular importance because they would actually take up very precious time which the brain needs to process the information it's interested in. So what happens is that in every nerve cell, every nerve network, we find this general rule applies that constant, unimportant signals are completely blocked. They're not actually passed on at all. And important sounds, or new sounds, are picked up and may be very actively enhanced or amplified. The reason that we have this very complex pattern recognition process is because it's part of our security system. This is something that's important for all animals, particularly those that live in the wild and are exposed to the possibility of being attacked by predators. It's essential for an animal that may get eaten by predators to be able to detect the attacker well before it arrives on the scene. Now, predators don't make a lot of noise or they don't get any lunch. So these sounds may be very, very weak and small, and they may be buried in a lot of background noise created by the tropical rainforest or wherever it happens that the animal is. And yet he has to extract that sound from the background sound and know the difference between, say, the sound of the snake in the grass and the sound of the wind in the grass. Now this requires very complex, sophisticated pattern recognition, and that's exactly what these subconscious pathways are for. Moreover, when they identify these threatening sounds, they do so very rapidly. Immediately, the patterns are recognized when they leave the ear, well before they get to the conscious part of the brain. Our experience of these kind of threats may be a little different. For instance, if we hear the sound of a creaking floorboard in the night when we're alone in the house, or if we're going to cross the road and we hear a motor horn. These signals we will always be aware of. They will never block or habituate or disappear. And this is another rule of the brain or the nervous system, that if sounds are classified as being threats, they don't disappear, they don't habituate. So we go on reacting to the creaking floorboard and the motor horn when we cross the road, the same way when we're 90 as we do when we're 19. And that's very important that it is so. The learning process of these things is important too. An animal, when it's exposed early on in its life to the presence of a predator, and sees the predator perhaps eating friends or relations, very rapidly learns that that sound means danger and will always respond very strongly whenever the sound is heard. So there's a very strong memory pattern put in the subconscious part of the brain which reacts whenever the predator appears. In addition to the enhanced perception of these threatening sounds, there is also the activation of a special reflex response when there is a danger signal. Now, this reflex response is generated automatically the moment the pattern is detected in the subconscious. What happens is that another message is sent across to another part of the brain called the limbic system, where our emotions are generated. These are our feelings, happy, happiness, unhappiness, anger, fear, guilt. We're all very familiar with these feelings. And in the case of an attack by a predator, the usual emotion that is generated is intense fear. This is important because it motivates us, or the animal, to actually do something about the situation before it becomes too late. Fear means I must get out of there, I must get away from this situation. And that's what is going to happen. Now, in order to facilitate this movement, because you may have been lying half asleep in bed and hearing this floorboard creaking slightly, what is needed is something to activate the body so that it's ready for this flight response, which is part of the survival reflex. And that occurs by stimulation not only of the limbic system to produce emotion, but also the autonomic nervous system. Now, this is an automatic connection with the brain to the body, and it's the way in which our heart rate, our breathing, our muscle tension, our sweating, and our general level of arousal is governed by the brain. The stomach and the bowels are also controlled in this way. And this is an automatic activity which we're very largely unaware of. However, if we are very badly frightened, for instance, if somebody came round the corner and stuck a gun at our head, we would be aware that our heart was beating very fast, we'd be breathing fast, our palms would be very sweaty, we would be very tense, and there would be lots of body changes which were going on, which would reflect that survival reflex being activated. There are other things that can stimulate this kind of response, perhaps not quite so strongly. In fact, anything which is annoying or irritating or represents a territorial intrusion, for instance, somebody coming to the door, somebody coming into your office and perhaps causing some problems for you, these things will all produce reactions with stimulation of our emotional and autonomic nervous systems, but to a lesser degree. And the amount of stimulation will depend on the significance and the strength of the threat as we perceive it. Some people get very powerful reactions to things that aren't threats at all. For instance, spiders or lifts or airplanes or high buildings very commonly create what we call phobic or aversive responses. What's happening in the brain is identical to what's happening in a survival reflex. That is to say, there is a nasty, unpleasant emotional reaction, and there are lots of body changes brought about by stimulation of the autonomic nervous system. We'll come back to these aversive or phobic reactions and the survival reflex a little bit later on, but I want to change the subject now and talk about an experiment which was performed in 1953 by two audiologists, Heller and Bergman. What they did was very simple but very profound. They took 80 normally hearing young adults from their university and made sure that they hadn't got any hearing problems or any tinnitus, and they put them into a soundproofed room where they did their hearing tests for just 5 minutes and asked them to listen very carefully. At the end of 5 minutes, they had to write down what they heard, and of course they expected to have a hearing test. In fact, what happened was they had 5 minutes of complete silence, and at the end of this time, what happened was they wrote down what they'd heard, and there weren't just 80 blank pieces of paper, but actually 94% of them describe hissing, ringing, pulsing, whistling sounds in their ears or head, which they'd never heard before, and which went away after they'd left the room. They didn't hear them again. Now, they repeated the experiment with 100 patients from a nearby hospital who had tinnitus and hearing loss and were complaining about the tinnitus. And when they went into the room, naturally they heard their tinnitus and they described what it sounded like. When they came at the end of the experiment to compare the descriptions in the two groups, they were actually completely identical. So what this shows us is that anybody who sits in a quiet room for 5 minutes can actually hear the same sound as tinnitus patients hear, and the only difference is that in this case, these tinnitus sounds just disappear after you leave the quiet environment. This means that essentially the emergence or ability to detect these internal sounds, which are identical to tinnitus, is virtually universal and completely normal because it's associated with normal hearing and people who haven't had this experience before or had any damage of any kind. The next thing we have to consider is what it is that they're actually listening to and where does this sound come from. Well, if we return to the anatomy and remember that what we hear with is the cortex of the brain and not the ear, what arrives at the cortex is what comes off the very top of that great column of neurons in the neuronal network, which leads from the ear up to the brain, and which is concerned with the pattern recognition and the enhancement and suppression of sounds as they are presented to us. Now, if there's a sound coming from outside, what we actually hear is the pattern being imprinted on the network, going up through the pathways and arriving at the hearing cortex. And that is a representation, of course, of the external sound. If there's no sound coming from outside, then what happens is that these neurons do not actually shut down. They continue to produce a background activity all of their own, which is random, it doesn't have any pattern in it, and it's quite slow and not very powerful. But this random background activity is the signature of a live neuron, and the whole neuronal network is making this sound and passing these signals up to the auditory cortex. Now, although it's supposed to be random, it very rarely actually does achieve this. And what happens in a very silent environment is that this background activity actually increases slightly. Now, one reason for this may be that in silence, the brain actually considers that there is the possibility of some threat. Before the predator actually strikes, everything goes very quiet. And that's a signal to the brain to increase its power of pattern recognition to look for the predator. So what happens if it becomes very silent rather than just quiet is that first of all the brain goes into a state of attention, almost of red alert. And secondly, there is an increase in the neurons in this subconscious pathway so that it can better pick out these possible warning signals from the environment around. Now, as the neuronal signals increase, what happens is that there is more synchronization and more of a loss of this random activity, and the brain detects a pattern and hears a sound. And that's what it is that people are listening to and hearing when they hear tinnitus, when they hear these internal sounds. And we call it the music of the brain. Now, there can be other sounds that people hear. It's not uncommon for people to complain about the fact that they can hear their heartbeat or muscle clicking or sound of their breathing. And these are body sounds. We call them somatosounds. And sometimes they can be picked up selectively by these filters, these neuronal networks, and amplified. And they can become troublesome. So they're very much the same, treated in very much the same way as the tinnitus. It's just that the origin is different. The origin is outside the hearing mechanism, coming usually from somewhere inside the head. Now, many people worry about the fact that they can hear these sounds because they think, well, if they can hear blood flowing, it must be abnormal blood flow, and it must be indicating possibly a stroke or something terrible going to happen. But in fact, that's not the case. What we know is that in these cases, blood flow is completely normal. The sounds have always been there. It's just that they are now being picked up by the filters. Now, this is all very well, but it doesn't tell us why people get continuous, persistent tinnitus and why they have a bad time with it. So in order to understand this, we need to look at the Jastreboff model, and this is the result of the work which was done by the neuroscientist Jastreboff in the 1980s. The paper was published in 1990 in Neuroscience Research, and it's now considered very widely by researchers and those people who are working seriously with tinnitus patients to be a very good description of what is going on. And it is quite dramatically different from what is in the classical accounts in textbooks and what lots of professionals sometimes will tell you about the mechanisms of tinnitus. So to understand what's going on, it's best to look at this model, this picture, which has five boxes on it. You can see that the five boxes have arrows which join them to the other boxes, and that those arrows go in both directions. And the arrows mean nerve connections between the boxes, so that signals can pass from one box to another, and are passing all the time. So if we start off with the source of the tinnitus, we've identified that that is the music of the brain, the background activity of these neurons in the neuronal networks, which are completely normal. And even in cases where there is noise damage to the ear, and there is a loss of hair cells because of noise damage, these neurons are not damaged. They don't experience damage from external sound. So even though changes in the ear may result in variations of nerve activity in the subconscious, which can lead to tinnitus being more noticeable, the nerve cells themselves, which are producing the sound, are actually completely normal. Now, there is no tinnitus until you first hear it. And what's happening until you first hear it is that the source is there. It's always there. It's there in everybody, except in people who are born totally without any hearing. They're the only people who don't have tinnitus. And this source only becomes noticeable when the filters tune to it. When the filters tune onto the source, then we get a perception of the sound for the first time. And that tuning may come on because we're just sitting in silence for 5 minutes, that's the Heller and Bergman experiment, or it may be that there is some alteration in our emotional state. We've had a bit of a shock, or we've had a nasty illness, or an operation, or an accident or something like that, or there's just a lot of stress at home or at work. And that produces changes in the emotional system, which itself will result in the filters widening, looking for trouble, as it were. And that's a situation which we've shown about 80% of our patients is the trigger for the tinnitus to become noticeable for the first time. Problem tinnitus is created after it's first heard. This may be immediately afterwards, or it may be a little bit later on. But what happens is that as we monitor the tinnitus, we begin to think that this is rather unpleasant. It's an intrusion into our right to be silent. We may be worried about the meaning of the noise. We may think that it means that there's some problem with our hearing. We may go deaf. Or most commonly, people may think that the tinnitus just may never go away and may go on forever, and that there's nothing that can be done about it. Unfortunately, this is an explanation, a message that is conveyed quite strongly by a lot of doctors and other professionals who perhaps are not aware of the real mechanism of tinnitus. Well, once you start to think that the tinnitus is something bad, even if you're just thinking of it in terms of an unwelcome guest, you will create a weak, aversive reaction to it. You will be trying to keep it out of the way. You'll be trying to push it away. You'll be wishing it wasn't there. And once you've generated this weak, aversive reaction, which, as we've seen, involves an emotional response and a body response through the autonomic nervous system, then when we detect that signal in the subconscious, it will, most times, produce this reaction and make us feel bad. Now, every time we feel bad and we react to the tinnitus, we actually send a message back to the filters to tune onto the source of the tinnitus, this music of the brain, and that's how it can become louder. Because the tinnitus changing or becoming louder has nothing to do with the source changing, it's all to do with what the filters are doing, with what these neuronal networks are doing in the case of pattern recognition. So this becomes a kind of vicious circle, and it is situated mostly at a subconscious level. There is a conscious loop which enhances this, involving further evaluation of the tinnitus as being a bad thing. It's the presence of the subconscious aversive or sometimes even phobic reaction to the tinnitus signal which keeps it going. And of course it's observation of people who have been highly phobic about their tinnitus because of their very powerful negative beliefs about it, which have generated most of the accounts of tinnitus in the textbooks and in the literature. This is unfortunate because it represents quite a small proportion of those people who actually experience tinnitus and don't have any problem with it at all. Of course, those people don't make the news. So this is the reason why tinnitus becomes persistent. As long as there is an aversive reaction there, you cannot habituate this particular signal. You cannot block it because the tinnitus is perceived as a threat or a danger signal in exactly the same way as the sound of a predator, the sound of the creaking floorboard at night, or the sound of the motor horn as we cross the road. Now, what are we going to do about this problem, and how can we reverse this and get rid of these unpleasant experiences which until now have been going on unabated or perhaps even getting worse? Well, the vital thing here is to get rid of the reaction, of the aversive reaction. Because until you do this, you will not be able to habituate the perception of tinnitus. Moreover, actually getting rid of the perception of tinnitus isn't what's important. Because if anybody sits in a quiet room for 5 minutes, they're going to hear it. And if you've had some experience in listening to tinnitus, it's almost certain that you will be able to pick it up from time to time in the future. And we can't prevent that. But if there is no aversive response, if there's no distress being caused, then those occasional experiences of hearing tinnitus will have no significance. There will be no physical or emotional response, and therefore it won't matter. And moreover, that experience of tinnitus will be quite short-lived as a result. So what we do is we have a retraining approach to tinnitus. And this retraining approach has a number of different components, which we will be talking about and following the results from over a period of time. The training does take time. On average, overall, I suppose it's about a year to 18 months before people are fully habituated. But some people get there quicker and some people take longer, and it's difficult to predict who will do which. First of all, we need to learn all about tinnitus, that is to say, learning the Jastrogoff model. And that's where this tape can come in very handy, because you can play it over and over again, and it really means a great deal, particularly if you listen to it with the illustrations which you've been provided with, so that you can really get a good picture of what's going on. When you understand it, it's also important, in fact essential, to believe the model, and to believe that that's what's happening to you, the specific aspects of the model that apply to your case. And then when you've done that, it becomes possible to reduce the negativity, the unpleasantness of the tinnitus and its meaning by re-evaluating what it means. Now, re-evaluating what the tinnitus means involves thinking about three things principally. It involves thinking about the music of the brain. It involves thinking about filters, subcortical pattern recognition processes, because they are the things which are constantly changing, and they're the things that are going to change in the long term. And also the Heller and Bergman experiment, which explains to us why this is such a natural phenomenon. So if you had little post-it stickers to put up with music of the brain, filters, Heller and Bergman experiment, it would be a good idea to do that in the various places where you are during the day. There's another exercise which is important, which I sometimes call the 10-second exercise. And what you do here is try and reduce your emotional and physical reaction to the tinnitus by a conscious effort of will. Now, we've all had experiences of trying to reduce our aversive reaction, our unpleasant feelings about somebody that we know, whom perhaps we work with, and who causes difficulties. But we have to get on with them. And instead of reacting and perhaps being rude to the person or telling them to go away, we actually have to suppress those feelings and get on with doing the job which we're sharing. Now, if you've ever done that, and almost everybody can remember having done that, this is the kind of technique that you need to use with your tinnitus. It is a kind of act of diplomacy. And what I recommend is just spending 10 seconds, quite a brief time, perhaps 10 times a day, when you encounter your tinnitus. And this encounter is very important. Very important not to try and deal with the situation by escaping from the tinnitus or ignoring it. The encounter is important. And encounter with the tinnitus with less reaction than you had before. That's why I call it an encounter and not a confrontation. Many people are confronting the tinnitus, fighting it, saying, I won't let it get me down. I won't let it cause me a problem. That's not the way to go about it. The way to go about it is to work towards making this unwelcome guest or the enemy your friend. And of course that's going to take a long time to do. So these 10-second episodes, very useful during the day. The other aspect of retraining is equally important, and this involves sound therapy. There are two ways that we can get at this area of the brain which is concerned with tinnitus distress. The first of these are these behavioral retraining approaches which get at the autonomic and limbic response. But the auditory system too responds to sound. That's its primary task. And so if we put sound into it on a regular basis, which contains as many of the frequencies that we can hear as possible, then as many of those nerve cells in the auditory system will be stimulated. And if they're stimulated, then they are changing, they are reacting, and things can then alter. We can make these connections which are causing the problem go into a state of change, or plasticity as it's called, And this will increase the rate at which habituation can occur. Now, it's very important that these sounds that we use for sound enrichment do not themselves cause any kind of annoyance or problem. Nature sounds are best, and there are devices like the Tsubo ball, which we use quite a lot, which can create nature sounds very gently and quietly. We don't want them too loud. And these sounds will take away silence. The main message is that we must avoid silence. Now, the sound enrichment needs to be performed all the time. If we're listening to music or the radio or TV or something like that, then obviously it's not necessary to enrich the sound environment. But it's a very good principle to have sound enrichment going all the time, because then when you turn off these sources of sound you're listening to, you're not left in silence. It's also important to have them during the night, because the subconscious pathways, of course, are working all through the night. They work regardless of whether the cortex is awake or asleep, and they're going on functioning as normal when the cortex shuts down at night. So we want to stimulate all these neurons as much as we can. And to find a sound, for instance, of a quiet domestic fan just blowing some air, which we can use at night, but which does not annoy us or irritate us, can sometimes be quite difficult. So a little bit of research is needed here, and help from the professionals who are guiding you in the TRT program. Quite a number of our patients need some kind of instrumentation. These are devices which are fitted to the ears, which look rather like hearing aids. And in most cases, we use a device called a white noise or wideband noise generator, or WNG for short. We almost always fit two, one to each ear, because it's very important to balance the auditory system and not create imbalance by putting sound into one side and not the other. That upsets the filters and can actually make tinnitus worse. Frequently does make tinnitus worse. In people who have a hearing impairment, we often think about fitting hearing aids instead of sound generators. And in that case, it's important too to balance the two ears. And when we have the hearing aids, to use sound enrichment all the time. It's no good having hearing aids and not putting any sound through them. So the message is to stimulate the auditory system with nice, pleasant sound all the time. The whole program is going to take some months, maybe more than a year. Sometimes even it takes a couple of years in people who are very distressed and have had tinnitus for a long time. The important thing is to continue in the program, to do the exercises on a daily basis, and to learn the information. The knowledge about the Jastrabov model is very powerful and an absolutely essential part of the retraining program. So if you're not clear about it, it is important that you ask, and we can put the ideas straight and answer the questions. It's always possible to answer questions, any questions about tinnitus, on the basis of the model. And quite soon, you'll be able to do this on your own without help. Just to remind you, the object of tinnitus retraining therapy is to get rid of the aversive reaction, of this reflex response which has been implanted into our subconscious. And so always think about your reaction and try and see whether or not you are actually making some progress in reducing it, because this is the object of the exercise. It doesn't matter what the tinnitus sounds like during this part of the treatment, and it will actually sound very similar for a long time. But gradually, the reaction will reduce, and there will be longer periods of time when you're hearing the tinnitus but not reacting to it. And that will be a very positive, helpful part of the program. If there's been sleep disturbance, then this is a period when the sleep will tend to return to normal, because sleep disturbance is the result of too much high level of autonomic activity. The increased arousal is what stops you going to sleep. And of course, it's entirely appropriate not to go to sleep if there are warning signals all the time being heard. As you gradually get rid of the aversive reaction, you'll notice that the tinnitus itself is changing. It may become quieter, and there are longer periods of time when you don't notice it at all. Eventually, it will only be heard just if you listen for it, and if you listen particularly in a quiet environment, although you'll always be able to hear it then. However, by that time, it won't matter, because the tinnitus itself will have a completely benign meaning. It will have become your friend rather than your enemy, and you will realize that it is simply a sound which indicates the wonderful functioning of your hearing mechanism, your selective hearing, and all the things that you're able to do with that. Everybody who follows this program improves. Only the people who don't follow it, who drop out, who look for other kind of solutions, who don't make progress. So I do encourage you to follow this program very carefully, to keep in touch with us, and to let us make assessments to show how you are improving and to give you answers where you get stuck. But at the end of the day, you will no longer have a problem with your tinnitus if you complete this program.